conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians. Cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we're presenting a rebroadcast of a Project Censored Show special we did in November of 2013. This was on the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. We did an entire series, but today we'd like to replay this segment with Oliver Stone, the award-winning filmmaker and author, whose 1992 film JFK led to the JFK Assassination Records Act and re-energized the conversation about the JFK assassination. Also interviewed was Peter Kuznick, American University historian and co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. Kuznick provides key historical context and background on the Kennedy administration and the political stakes in those turbulent times. Please stay with us for this special rebroadcast of the Project Censored Show. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys. And the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons filled the capacity citizens. In the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. This is part of a special for the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Our guests for the hour are award-winning filmmaker and author Oliver Stone. His film JFK stirred controversy over 20 years ago. It's been re-released. Oliver Stone is also a co-author of The Untold History of the United States. That's also available now on Warner Brothers on Blu-ray DVD. Also a book, The Untold History of the United States. And he's co-author with Peter Kuznick. Dr. Peter Kuznick is our other guest today that joins us in conversation. He is, with Oliver Stone, co-author of Untold History of the United States. And Peter Kuznick joins us as a historian from American University. We're joined now by Oliver Stone. Hollywood director has won numerous Academy Awards for his work on such iconic films as Platoon, Wall Street, and JFK, among others. Also is co-author with historian Peter Kuznick of The Untold History of the United States. And Oliver Stone joins us today to talk about his film JFK and, of course, the ensuing research that's come along thereafter. Oliver Stone, thanks for joining us.
Hello, Mickey. How are you?
Doing really well. We're delighted to have you with us today to talk about JFK. Your film JFK is also being re-released. What can we expect to see from a re-release?
Well, the re-release is timed in a new Blu-ray to the 50th anniversary, and it also includes Chapter 6 of The Untold History, which is JFK to the Brink, which I think positions historically very, very well the conflict in which JFK found himself when he became president. Peter and I look at his time in office as a crux, as a crucial interregnum between the Eisenhower years, which creates and accelerates the military-industrial complex to an enormous degree, and then puts Kennedy in a position of great danger with at the edge of nuclear war, and ending with Johnson taking back the government from Kennedy, in a sense, and going on with the Eisenhower policies. So it's a very interesting picture. It doesn't deal with the assassination at all. It simply posits what Kennedy faced and what he leaves behind. But you get the sense that forces larger than himself, larger than one single assassin, were at work to destroy him.
Oliver, I watched the director's cut of your JFK movie last night. And as I'm thinking about it, I've been reading quite a bit about the assassination when we were getting ready to produce this documentary, and I've read a number of books. And I really have to ask you, this is a movie, of course, but in many ways it's a documentary. The facts that you have in this movie are one by one laid out what we know about the assassination. So how would you characterize JFK in terms of being documentary fiction? I mean, you really cover it quite specifically.
having done Untold History, I mean, we did three fact checks. It was done as a documentary. JFK, the movie in 1991, was my taking, my and my co-writer Zach Sklar were taking from many different sources, and had, because it was a three-hour movie, we had to simplify, condense. We did all, we have actors, we have sets, it was constructed as a movie, as a drama. But we tried to be as faithful as possible to the research as we knew it then. And, of course, you know, it got into a ridiculous controversy about what I was making up or not making up. I often find that the critics of the movie never have ever read anything that was contrary.
That seems to be often the case. I mean, you cite Crossfire, Jim Mars, as one of your sources, certainly Garrison and his work. Peter Dale Scott says he talked with you, as did Mark Lane.
Oh, many people. We had Bob Groden, Cyril Wecht. I mean, I'm here in Pittsburgh now, the 50th anniversary. They're doing Cyril Wecht, who is a forensic pathologist. He did a lot of work on the autopsy work, as did Groden. I mean, many of the experts are here, the bullet experts.
Well, that comes across in the movie quite clearly. Now, you write in the...
Here in Pittsburgh, there was a surgeon in ER, the ER room, by the name of McClellan, Robert McClellan. He was a young surgeon. He was the first doctor in the trauma room. He noticed the massive wound in the back of Kennedy's skull. It was bleeding, and he said here to the panel, he said, the cerebellum was practically falling out of his head, which indicates a shot from the front.
Exactly. You write in the introduction to Colonel Prouty, its book, Fletcher Prouty, that I've been ridiculed and worse for suggesting the existence of a conspiracy, as though only kooks, cranks, and extremists suggest the existence of such a thing. And we went back and looked at some of the New York Times coverage of JFK when it came out. I mean, they were pretty brutal. A revitalization of Americans' obsessions with conspiracies, writes Clifford Klaus of the New York Times.
Yeah.
Arthur Schlesinger says, conspiracy theory, reckless, paranoid, despicable.
Right.
And I'm sure you remember a lot of this, conspiracy theory, get the rest of the JFK story from the New York Times. So you really got beat up over this. And let's say something about conspiracy theories, because certainly we know now the CIA had put memorandums out to all of their correspondents in the 60s saying use the word conspiracy theory to discredit discussions of the Warren Commission report that don't agree with it. And we know that now. We also know that the Mockingbird journalists across the country, thousands of them, were coordinated. Do you feel you were a victim of that?
To some degree, yes. When a population is not educated about something, they naturally would turn against a new thought. I mean, Peter and I had the same issue when we started talking about the atomic bomb on the Japanese in 1945, you know, that there was no reason to drop it. Well, if you're sloppily educated or you buy into the propaganda that's repeated over and over again, you naturally resist what Peter and I were saying about the atomic bomb. But it's important to do your homework, and it's important to read the alternative thought. And that's what we were offering in this movie. It was very effective. I think it went around the world. The movie was very successful. On the other hand, it hasn't stopped for me. I mean, I have been branded, and I have been pigeonholed as a, quote, as you said, ridiculous terminology, a conspiracy theorist, although my other work doesn't necessarily suggest that, and our untold history is not about conspiracies. It's very much based in fact. So I think the conspiracy is truly much bigger. The conspiracy that I grew up under, that was told to us by our fathers and our books, was that the Russians and the Chinese were going to get together to dominate, take over America. And McCarthy, inside our country, was the biggest conspiracy theorist of all, was saying that the Russians, the communists, are in our schools and our governments, and are taking over from in our military even, etc. So how crazy do we have to be? George Bush goes into Iraq and he thinks that Iraq was part of 9/11. This thinking about conspiracy in this country is always been there. It's gigantic.
It's definitely a means by which to diffuse any rational discourse, any reasonable arguments that are made. And you certainly have called that out in many of your public talks, both in Untold History and also in the introduction to Prouty's book. And of course, at Project Censored, we've dealt with the same kind of thing by uncensoring these kinds of stories. And the conspiracy theory label is, it's very ironic in many ways because it acts to cover up conspiracy realities. There was a conspiracy to kill JFK.
Exactly.
Let's talk about that.
If Edward Snowden had not existed and I had come along and made a movie and said that the government is listening in on all your phone calls and has a record of everything and because they're looking for a needle in a haystack, I mean, I would have been called nuts. You know, thank God there was a Snowden to back it up. Ellsberg says something like that, too. But, you know, Jim Garrison was like Ellsberg, and he was like Snowden, but he was an anti-hero because he was misunderstood. His trial doesn't look so bad now. Yeah, he had a lot of difficulties, but he was trying to bring accusations in the light of day about covert operations of the United States government. And it was very difficult with the press against him and the leaks, the stealing and all this, to get his thinking across. But what he was saying, essentially, if you go back and read what he said, is essentially true about Kennedy, that he was killed for a motive. The motive was that he was a peacekeeper at a wrong time in this world when we wanted, basically, and I think we go into this in Untold History, we had such superiority militarily over the Soviet Union that many people, many serious people in this country in 1960, 61, by then, were really looking to fight a war with the Soviet Union because we thought we could win it, destroy them, and at the same time not suffer enough retaliation to worry us, which was sort of the scenario of Dr. Strangelove. These guys were ready to go to war. Kennedy was the one guy who said no at a key time.
More than once in the film, you used the word coup d'etat, or there was a coup with the assassination of Kennedy. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Actually, you have Garrison use the word fascism.
None of which I could back down from. I would support that theory. Is Peter on this phone call?
Yeah, Oliver, hi.
Peter Kuznick okay also joins us.
As a coup d'etat, yes. A coup d'etat means that you have to have someone in place to take over who's going to not prosecute you for what you did. I think that's a pretty clear definition of what Johnson did. Whether he knew something in advance or not remains to be proven, but certainly by appointing Alan Dulles, the head of the Warren Commission, you have a perfect coup d'etat, which means you never get prosecuted for it. As to fascism, that's a very interesting word. It implies where I think our country is coming to today, where we have this gigantic nexus between government and corporations that control the country and the so-called free press. Go ahead, Peter.
The Washington Post did a number of public opinion polls about the Kennedy assassination. And during the Garrison investigation, 66% of the public believed that there was a conspiracy, that Oswald didn't act alone. And even in May of 1991, only 19% thought that Oswald acted alone in Washington Post polls. So Oliver was out there most prominently, but he certainly wasn't out there on his own in this kind of stuff.
Well, that's the case. And when you talk about things like coup d'etat and Oliver Stone, you just mentioned the nexus between corporations and the state. And, you know, just prior to Kennedy taking office was the farewell address of Dwight Eisenhower, warning about this military-industrial complex and warning about what Peter Dale Scott refers to as a deep state or deep politics, where there's just an entirely different agenda afoot. And in Untold History, Oliver Stone, you and Peter Kuznick call out what Kennedy was wanting to do and trying to do and sort of set up the motives for how this covert or continuity of government police state would want to take somebody like him out. My question to you is, can you explain a little more detail, maybe, who are some of the people that you see at the center of this so-called coup d'etat?
I can't go there. I mean, it would be a simplification. You know, I can't give these kind of news bites because they're misunderstood.
Well, Oliver, the House Committee on Assassination came to the conclusion in the 70s that there was, in fact, a conspiracy. Now, we've never gone beyond that in the sense of really a further investigation. Could you comment on why the government drags its feet in this regard? I mean, could there be a movement now to really push this on the 50th anniversary to get the truth?
Listen, I'm here in Pittsburgh at a conference Cyril Wecht has organized for the 50th anniversary of his death, of Kennedy's death. Cyril Wecht was a forensic pathologist who did a tremendous amount of work on the autopsy, showing, frankly, that it was a medical fraud what happened, and that the government autopsyists were dishonest people. There are so many eyewitnesses to this head wound. We talked about it. Robert McClellan came out yesterday. He was an intern. No, he was a young surgeon at the trauma room here at Parkland. He came out in the paper here. He's at this conference. He hasn't spoken a word. He's 80-some years old, 84 years old, and he said that he saw a massive wound to the back of his skull. The cerebellum was falling out through the back of his right skull, indicating, of course, a blow from the front, a shot from the front. So he was shot from more than one side. That's what's very clear to 30 or 40 eyewitnesses, as well as many people in Dealey Plaza that day, people who were in Parkland and at the autopsy itself. This has been covered up because of fear. So once you have more than one gunman, it's clear that this is much more complicated murder. And that's been the basic fear. That's why they invented this magic bullet theory, single bullet theory, which is insane. it's Alice in Wonderland for me. I don't understand how people who could invent the internet and invent all the technology we have still buy into the single bullet theory.
Oliver, in the beginning of the movie, you have the quote, "Sin by silence, when we should protest, makes cowards of all men," by
yeah.
Ella Wheeler Wilcox. Certainly that's commentary on what you're saying right now.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's not just that. It's the whole pattern since World War II for me. Peter and I spent a long time thinking about this series, and it's a depressing pattern, but there is hope. But the Kennedy murder is one of these, perhaps the greatest crime of that century. But some people might argue that dropping the atomic bomb when we didn't have to was also a great crime. Vietnam was a great crime. Iraq was a great crime. I mean, we're repeat criminals, you know. We keep doing it, but we don't learn enough from it. I hope to God one day we will.
Oliver Stone, with the reissue of the film JFK and the symposium you're at, do you see momentum maybe picking up? Do you think that given the revelations of people like Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden and so on that you'd mentioned prior, do you think that we're coming on a tipping point maybe here in the United States?
Oh, Mickey, I don't know. Hope to see a tipping point. I'd like to, you know, maybe this the government shutdown was a positive thing because maybe it would have made sense to cease to look to the United States as the world's sole reserve currency. You know, it's a gradual thing, but it's a delinking. It's not thinking of the United States as the ultimate bearer of the bond. Perhaps that is a good thing, but I don't see any evidence that we're cutting down on our empire or our military empire. The money is always there for those people to keep going. We have 10 times what the Chinese do with it. We spend more money on security and defense than all the other countries combined. I don't understand it, but I certainly root for the end of it.
Mickey, you talk about tipping points. One of the important developments recently was the public opposition to a military attack on Syria. And Oliver and I wrote that we think that it was good that what Putin did. We just wish his timing had been different because it would have sent a great signal had both houses of Congress repudiated a military attack on Syria, and that was about to happen. So there are a lot of signs right now, not only of weariness, but of actual opposition to many of these kinds of military policies that the United States has been embracing.
That's the voice of Professor Peter Kuznick from American University. We're also speaking with filmmaker and author Oliver Stone on the 50th anniversary of JFK. Oliver, we know that you have to go and you have some other meetings to tend to, but do you have any last things to say here for the Pacifica broadcast about the 50th anniversary of JFK?
I would honestly feel that it's not a soundbite. You know, I think that Peter Kuznick and I contributed to the Kennedy story and his importance to American life by putting him into our untold history of the United States as the last major peace-seeking president who achieved something great in his life. I don't even think we'd be having this conversation if it had not been for Kennedy and Khrushchev. I think there would have been a nuclear war in 1962. So everything we owe to a man with great character who was able to say no to a military that essentially wanted to start a war. That's pretty significant. I'll leave it at that for now, but if you can certainly look at Chapter 6 of Untold History.
Oliver Stone, thanks so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us today.
Sure.
Repeating this bulletin, President Kennedy shot while driving in an open car from the airport in Dallas, Texas to downtown Dallas. Recounting again the details of this incident, three shots were heard to ring out as Kennedy and Governor Connally and Mrs. Kennedy rode in the back seat of the open car. Immediately, a Secret Service man said he saw blood spurt from the president's head. He fell into the laps of Mrs. Kennedy, and Mrs. Kennedy shouted, "Oh, no." Governor Connally was seen to crumple also. The car sped on. The motorcade speeded up, rushed to Parkland Hospital in Dallas, where the president and Governor Connally were rushed to the emergency room. A Secret Service man was heard to say, "He's dead," as the president was lifted from the rear of the White House touring car, the famous bubble top from Washington, and taken into the hospital. Reporters about five car lengths behind the chief executive heard what sounded like that three bursts of gunfire. We will keep you advised as more details come in. The incident has taken place only in the last few minutes in Dallas. Stay tuned to CBS News for further details.
We're joined by Peter Kuznick, historian from American University, also co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. Peter Kuznick, talk a little bit about how Oliver Stone was pilloried for this film and for these views on JFK.
Well, the attacks began 6 months before the movie was released, based on a first draft of the script that was stolen from the set. It was a closed set, and it was stolen. And then based on that first draft, which was going to be greatly revised, the attacks started to come. Nothing like that really ever happened before. So it begins with the Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune, the New York Times. The New York Times had dozens of articles, even in advance, attacking Oliver. They clearly wanted to suppress this. And the public response, though, was very different. But Oliver was being called an intellectual sociopath by George Will. He was attacked by Anthony Lewis, Tom Wicker, some of the leading journalists in the country. But the effect of this film, the positive impact of this film was enormous. It made a fortune at the box office, opened people's eyes, people began to question, and based on this film, George Bush set up the Assassination Records Review Board, which released millions of documents, millions of pages as a result, and a lot of it, we didn't find any smoking gun, but we found a lot of very, very interesting information that we wouldn't have had if it hadn't been for Oliver's film and the success of this film. So even though he was criticized as to taking certain liberties with the truth, putting in some composite characters, mixing documentary footage with stage footage that he himself did, confusing people about certain things, the effect of this film was enormous. And we know a lot more about the Kennedy assassination than we would have otherwise. There wasn't a smoking gun, and we didn't expect there to be a smoking gun. That's not the way conspiracies work. People don't write these things down. But there was a lot of information. Oliver was talking about the head wound and the autopsy. We know that the head of the team of pathologists, Dr. James Humes, admitted that he burned the original autopsy notes and the original draft of the autopsy, and then he substituted later versions. We know that FBI agents Francis O'Neill and James Sibert and photographer James Stringer, who took the autopsy photos, claim that the current photos of Kennedy's brain are not in any way representative of the actual condition of the brain. We know that Doug Horn, the staff member of the Assassination Records Review Board, the board's chief analyst for military records who supervised digitizing the autopsy photos, wrote a lengthy report that said that the evidence pertaining to Kennedy's head wounds was deliberately falsified following the assassination. And Horn, who's a former naval officer, told the Washington Post, says, "I'm 90-95% certain the photographs in the archives are not of Kennedy's brain." He says, "If they aren't, that can only mean one thing. There's been a cover-up of medical evidence." He says that they performed a second autopsy on a different brain that reflected a shot from behind. Lots of other evidence came out, just casting more doubt upon the Warren Commission and this single bullet theory. So Oliver did a tremendous service by this film, but his reputation has taken an enormous hit. People come up to me all the time and say, "Oh, I don't like Oliver Stone." And I say, "Why?" "He's a great filmmaker." And I said, "I know he's a wonderful person." But they say, "Oh, because the movie JFK was such a disservice and it was so misleading." Yeah, he took certain liberties there, but all filmmakers do.
Maybe explain a little bit about that, because I watched that whole three-hour director's cut last night, and factually, it seemed right on. Now, he's been accused of using trick photography, spurious evidence in the Kennedy. I mean, this is, I'm reading here from a New York Times quote in January of 92. So, sure, it's a movie. And the dialogue, of course, with Garrison and his wife and other things, of course, was written as a script.
Mm-hmm.
But the factual pieces of what happened and the factual evidence around Oswell and the doubts about him and his involvement with military intelligence, his double dealing, multiple Oswells, or, you know, a phony Oswell in Mexico City, all of that, I mean, is important factual evidence.
Yeah, there's a lot that's suggestive. There's a lot that people need to question about this. Ruby's angle in this, Oswald's background in terms of possible military intelligence, how he got back as a double agent so easily. There's so much that's worth questioning. And Oliver never claims that he knows the answer. What he said is that the Warren Commission created a myth, and his goal was to create a counter-myth. And the problem was, the reason why people are so disturbed, is that they found the counter-myth to be much more convincing and plausible than the original story put out by the Warren Commission. And we know that 4 of the 7 members of the Warren Commission had their own serious doubts about their own report and about the magic bullet. 4 of the 7 members. But McCloy, who also had his own doubts, that we have to be unanimous. We've got to put up this front. Part of their mandate was not just to get at who did this, but it was to actually calm public suspicion and anxiety.
It's true also that even McCloy didn't necessarily believe the findings. And it's hard to not draw parallels to the 9/11 Commission report, though we're not going to open that can of worms here now. But so many of the same problems of people on the commission saying they were obstructed, they didn't get to see much of, they didn't get to answer a lot of questions. And again, this is what leads people to, like you said,
they didn't know basic things. They didn't even know about Operation Mongoose. They didn't know that the U.S. was involved in this attempt to assassinate and overthrow the Cuban government, this covert operation that Ed Lansdale was running. Basic, basic things that were going on, CIA, FBI records. They didn't know that the FBI agent had erased his contacts with Oswald. Various things that are very important in terms of the record were either cleansed or were not given to the members of the Warren Commission. So they were operating somewhat in the dark, but they also wanted to dispel the idea that this could have been any kind of conspiracy. One of the obvious places they might have looked was the Soviet Union, right? This was the heart of the Cold War. We know, of course, that this was a point when Kennedy and Khrushchev were actually trying to settle things. They were trying to calm the Cold War. They were trying to end the Cold War, the two of them. The two of them had a vision for a different kind of relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union. The point that we make, Oliver and I make, in Untold History, is that Kennedy had a lot of enemies, and that Kennedy knew that such a thing was possible. He got an advance copy of 7 Days in May in 1962, which is a novel and a movie about a coup overthrowing a liberal president who wanted to end the Cold War. Very, very similar, of course, to what actually might have happened. And Kennedy read it, and he says to a friend, says, you know, this could happen. He said if there was a first Bay of Pigs, they would think maybe he's in over his head. The second Bay of Pigs, the military would start to really get worried. So if there's a third Bay of Pigs, they would think that they had to act in the interests of the country, and they would move in and effectively overthrow the president. We argue that there were at least 7 or 8 Bays of Pigs. There was the Bay of Pigs itself, and the Joint Chiefs were furious that Lemnitzer and others accused Kennedy almost of treason for not sending in support in the Bay of Pigs. There was the neutralization of Laos. There was the Cuban Missile Crisis. And LeMay and the others said we lost because we didn't go in there and overthrow the Cuban government. LeMay wasn't even concerned about war with the Soviet Union. He says, well, we've got an advantage. If we're going to do it, let's get it on now, and we'll beat them. The fourth Bay of Pigs was Vietnam. Kennedy wanted to withdraw from Vietnam. And he says that in NSAM 263, and he says it to a lot of people he spoke to. The fifth Bay of Pigs was the Test Ban Treaty. Kennedy was very proud about the Test Ban Treaty. Sorensen says that was his proudest moment in the White House when that passed. But the military was furious, and then they did everything they could to resist it. The sixth Bay of Pigs was the space race. That was Kennedy's signature initiative. Kennedy called for ending the space race and said the U.S. and the Soviets should work together, hand in hand, go into space for peaceful exploration. The seventh Bay of Pigs was the American University's commencement address, which we're very proud of. And I'm going to be speaking to members of the class of 63 at American University about this because they were there. And what Kennedy called for there is possibly the greatest presidential speech of the 20th century. And he calls for an end to the Cold War. It's a huge visionary speech. Wonderful. It was also his attempt to curb the CIA. After the first Bay of Pigs, he talks about those CIA bastards and those Joint Chiefs sons of bitches. He says, I'm going to shred the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter it in the winds. And then he puts the CIA station chief under the ambassador in every country. He cuts back on them and really cracks down on the CIA. And he fires the big three of the CIA, the top three people in the CIA, including Alan Dulles, who later is part of this Warren Commission. I mean, so Kennedy had enemies. He had the right enemies. His enemies included The heads of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, they included some of the top people in the CIA, some top people in the military, and right-wingers around the country. They considered him to be a great campaigner for civil rights, although his record wasn't as good as it should have been from our perspective. But that's not the way he was viewed by the right-wingers. The Cuban exile community hated him for not supporting the exiles when they invaded during the Bay of Pigs. And had a lot of enemies. The anti-Castro Cubans were among them, the mafia, the CIA. So there were a lot of people who had motive to kill Kennedy. None of us can know who actually did it. As Norman Mailer said in talking about Oliver's movie, he says it's a great movie. He says, but nobody could ever make an accurate movie about the Kennedy assassination because there's too much that isn't known, will never be known, and can't be known.
Well, Peter Kuznick, that was one of the points that I was making with Oliver Stone when I was asking him to sort of sum up what he thinks about this issue as a counterbalance to the fact that those that are willing to cast aspersions and use the conspiracy theory label often create a straw person and claim that Stone was saying so many things that he didn't say. And it's important to differentiate between the asking of the questions and disproving the official narrative, right? That's not necessarily the same as positing an alternate explanation that isn't evidenced by facts.
Right. He's raising questions. He's putting out possibilities, different theories. Sort of a composite work of the best research that had been done at that time by the leading analysts who were just questioning the official version. And that's what he was trying to do. And many reporters at the time and reviewers thought it was a fabulous film. And people should also read the comments by people like Roger Ebert, the great reviewer, Andrew Kopkind in The Nation, Ellen Goodman in The Boston Globe, David Anson in Newsweek, David Denby in New York Magazine. But a lot of people were wildly enthusiastic about this movie, thought it was not only gripping as a movie, but that it allowed for discussion of serious issues in a way that nobody else in Hollywood was. And Oliver took out a lot of things. You know, Kevin Costner is the protagonist. Kevin Costner plays Garrison. Kevin Costner was a Republican, fairly conservative for a Hollywood person. He voted for George H.W. Bush. He played golf with Bush the day before they filmed that great Mr. X scene with Donald Sutherland. And Costner says that anytime he questioned Oliver about something, that if Oliver couldn't defend it, then they removed it. And Costner says, I was speculative throughout. He said, I said things like, you know, what if, or let's speculate, or maybe this, you know, just think for a minute. And they did that. So if you watch it closely, as my students do, because I assign it in one of my classes for the students, and then I also bring in the country's leading critic of the film. I want the students to get very different perspectives on it, and they do. And I have them read things on both sides because it's important for students and for the public to think critically. And that's really what you and I know, and Peter knows, that as professors, our job is to get them to think. It's not to give them the truth. It's to get them to question. And that's what this movie does.
Well, one of the key things that happened immediately after the assassination, of course, was the issue of Executive Order 273, which contradicted Kennedy's 263, which where Kennedy had asked for the withdrawal of 1,000 troops from Vietnam and complete withdrawal within a year or two.
Yeah.
And Johnson immediately the next day goes in and expands the operations, talks in terms of, you know, permanency and troop buildup. Of course, the Tonkin Gulf happened, or didn't really happen, but was used as an excuse to expand military in Vietnam. And we end up with this war killing 3 million people.
When Robert McNamara came into my class, he told my students that he accepts that 3.8 million Vietnamese died in the war. You know, and it's significant in a sense, because I often ask students or audiences, how many Americans died in the war? And somebody, some smart person, is going to know 58,000.
175. 58,175.
Well, they're actually 58,272.
Oh, there you go.
Up there now, if you want to know, get exact.
Peter's got his numbers down.
Nice.
But then I asked this. Then I asked people how many Vietnamese died in the war, and I just did this yesterday. And one hand, first hand, goes up and says 300,000 Vietnamese. Another person says 1.3 million. It went around, and that was the highest guess that this group had, 1.3 million. Then I asked them how many Jews died in the Holocaust. Every hand goes up. Everybody knows 6 million. And I tell them that Robert McNamara told my students that 3.8 million Vietnamese died in the war. And what does that say to them? That they know how many atrocities were committed by the Nazis, but they have no idea how many atrocities are committed by their own government. I asked them, how would you feel if you found out that German college students believe that 500,000 Jews died in the Holocaust instead of 6 million or 1 million? You'd be outraged at the criminal negligence of German education. And then I explained to them that they go down to the Vietnam War wall, it's got the names of 58,272 Americans. The message of the Vietnam Wall is that the tragedy of Vietnam was that 58,000 Americans died. I told them about, Oliver and I were in Japan together this summer. We went to Okinawa. The Okinawa War Memorial has the names of all the Japanese who died in battle there, all the Americans who died, all the Okinawans who died, all the Brits, all the Aussies, everybody who died. And that sends a certain message. The Vietnam Wall now is 146 feet long. If we included the names of all the Vietnamese, all the Cambodians, all the Laotians, and all the others who died in that invasion by the United States, it would be over 4 miles long. Over 4 miles long. It's 146 feet long now. Now, that would be a war memorial or an anti-war memorial, which is what every war memorial should be.
One of the issues that is often brought up is that the Warren Commission report was, you know, Earl Warren was the Supreme Court Justice, former governor of California, a trusted statesperson. Why would he go along with the cover-up? And one response, certainly Mark Lane's response and a number of others, is that he was essentially told that the Cubans or the Russians were behind it and it would cause a world war.
Yeah, that's part of the speculation. Part of the speculation is that they saw that Earl Warren, who was a decent enough man and certainly showed some courage at other points, believed that his social responsibility, his civic duty, was to quiet things down, tamp it down, not to raise suspicions, to quell the suspicions. In the long run, he's not doing the country any service by not probing more deeply. When they created the Assassination Records Review Board, one of the five members who was appointed by Clinton, who was in office by the time that they actually set it up, was my friend Anna Nelson, who taught with me at American University, passed away last year very sadly. But she was an expert in archives, and she went through the sources. A lot of what they were supposed to release, they never got a hold of. A lot of resistance to what they were trying to get before their mandate ran out. And her view is that it's indeterminate. You can't really know, based upon the evidence, that a lot of things that were being covered up were for other reasons, but that we don't know. We can't know. So in that sense, we can only question who had a motive to kill him, who had the capability of doing it, and then what evidence do we have? We can't know for sure. I do know from people that members of the administration, and including some very influential people, believe that there were some high-level people involved, possibly involved in the assassination. But again, we don't know. So the question that Oliver and I raise, which is why we don't go into the question of who did it in our documentary, I didn't want to do that because I don't believe that I know. We talk about who had a motive, who hated Kennedy, why they hated him, why he had made so many enemies, and he had made the right enemies for the most part, and how that changed the country. Because Kennedy and Khrushchev were both going to be gone soon. Had there been two other people in power, had Barack Obama been in the White House in 1962 during the Cuban Missile Crisis, instead of John Kennedy, probably half the world would be gone now. You know, it took a remarkable man like Kennedy, and Kennedy doesn't start out that way, as you guys know. Kennedy was a cold warrior. Kennedy was somewhat hawkish. He didn't come from a progressive family. His father was an old multimillionaire reactionary. His brother, Robert, starts off working for Joseph McCarthy. He's on McCarthy's staff in the Senate. So this was not a family that began as great liberals. Kennedy resisted that. He later said it took a long time for him to develop his liberalism. He said some people are born with it. I figured it out slowly, gradually. But after the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy and Khrushchev both understood how close we had come to annihilation. And had we done what was being pushed on Kennedy, which would have been the strike against the missiles there in Cuba, followed by an invasion, which is what the Joint Chiefs wanted, We had no idea what we were going to find there. We didn't know where many of the warheads were. We didn't realize that they had been loaded in many cases. But one of the main things we didn't know was that there were 100 battlefield nuclear weapons that would almost certainly have been used against an invading American force. We figured initially, we estimated there were going to be 10,000 armed Soviets. There were 43,000. We estimated there were 100,000 armed Cubans. There were 270,000. We had no idea we were going in there blind. And when McNamara found out in 92 about the battlefield nuclear weapons, he turned white. And he said, because his calculation was in an invasion, we were going to lose 4,500 Americans in an invasion. He, at that point, said we would have lost 100,000 Americans in an invasion. We would have taken out Cuba for sure, and very likely a full-scale nuclear war with the Soviet Union. So that's how close we came to an outcome that we can't begin to measure, because we certainly could have defeated the Soviet Union in a nuclear war at that point, but we don't know if that would have been enough to trigger nuclear winter, which could have ended all life on the planet, aside from American cities being taken out. When Dan Ellsberg asked the Pentagon for an assessment of how many would be killed in a nuclear war, he found out it was 1961. He said, just from the American weapons alone, up to about 600 to 650 million would be killed from the American weapons, ignoring Soviet retaliatory capabilities.
Brian Guide in our newsroom. There has been an attempt, as perhaps you know now, on the life of President Kennedy. He was wounded in an automobile driving from Dallas Airport into downtown Dallas, along with Governor Connally of Texas. They've been taken to Parkland Hospital there. Let's go back to KRLD in Dallas.
Word just came to us a minute ago. The word we have is that President Kennedy is dead. He was shot by an assassin at the intersection of Elm and Houston streets, just as he was going into the underpass. The word we have is from a doctor on the staff of Parkland Hospital.
That was Eddie Barker at our affiliate KRLD in Dallas, Texas. We have just learned Father Huber, one of the two priests called into the room, has administered the last sacrament of the church to President Kennedy. Regarding the probable assassin, the sheriff's officers have taken a young man into custody at the scene, a man 25 years old. We just have a report from our correspondent Dan, rather in Dallas, that he has confirmed that President Kennedy is dead.
Peter Kuznick, all this history behind Kennedy leading up to the assassination, I mean, this is an integral component. This context, the historical context, is very important for people to try to understand. And this is part of the broader story. And I have to agree, it's not about the smoking gun, and it's not about knowing the exact narrative. What we do know is damning enough that the Warren Commission report is whitewashing. It's more of a covering or a diffusing or obfuscation of the things that happened. What Oliver Stone said earlier in the interview, that a lot of the people that were calling names and dismissing the work from the film JFK, and of course some of the same or similar detractors now from your work, Untold History of the United States, these are people that really haven't looked at the sources. And in terms of Kennedy, they haven't read Deep Politics and the Death of JFK by Peter Dale Scott. They haven't read JFK, the CIA, Vietnam, and the Plot to Assassinate Kennedy by L. Fletcher Prouty. They haven't read Jim Marr's Crossfire, the plot that killed Kennedy. And now I'd urge people not only to read these books, and Peter Phillips has been reading umpteen books just over the summer here in preparation for the show, Mark Lane and many others. I'd urge people to read The Untold History of the United States. You have a 50-plus page chapter, JFK, the Most Dangerous Moment in Human History, that goes into even more detail than you just did. So I'd have to laud you for the process of questioning, and we hope 50 years on that really, as we said earlier with the tipping point, we hope that we have a society now that will really engage in the type of critical questioning required to really have a true democratic society.
Mickey, sounds like a real historian speaking. I agree with you, of course.
Yeah.
because Kennedy understood the stakes, and Khrushchev understood the stakes. where Khrushchev said after the crisis was resolved, the Cuban Missile Crisis, he said, maybe some good can come from this evil. And he said that what we need to do is resolve all the potential conflict areas between us. Any situation that could lead to a crisis that could put us at the brink of war again should be resolved peacefully, he said to Kennedy, and you and I can do that. And he reached out. He was the one, even more than Kennedy, initially, who aggressively tried to address all of these problems. And it was partly through Sorensen played an important role in this, but one of the key individuals was Norman Cousins. And Norman Cousins, who was one of the founders of SANE, Norman Cousins, who goes back to editor Saturday Review, was instrumental in helping build the anti-nuclear movement, worked closely with people in Hiroshima to bring the Hiroshima Maidens to the United States for surgery in 1955, had this long history as being anti-nuclear and pro-peace. He was the one who, as Kennedy's emissary, reached out to Khrushchev. Khrushchev and Norman Cousins met for hours and hours, and then Norman Cousins came back and spoke to Kennedy and convinced Kennedy that the Soviet leaders, especially Khrushchev, were absolutely serious about wanting to resolve these issues. And that's what led to the partial test ban treaty. In fact, Cousins, according to certain accounts by one of my graduate students, Peter Piotrowin, actually wrote the first draft of Kennedy's great American University commencement address. I mean, there's a lot of back history there that Kennedy understood what Eisenhower was talking about in his military-industrial complex speech in ways that Eisenhower didn't. And Eisenhower was one of those who urged Kennedy to invade during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Peter, as a sociologist, I've taken a long look and studied for a long time on what we call state theory. And that goes, of course, back to C. Wright Mills and the power elite. Mm-hmm. About the same time Eisenhower is worrying about the military-industrial complex, Mills is saying, you know, we have a government, economic, business elite in the country, and that they're behind-the-scenes decision-making. Democracy is somewhat of a front. But there's been debates within sociology for a long time as to what degree state operators are involved, members of the government, versus a class-based, upper-class perspective. Now, both of these resist conspiracies inside of government, or very strongly resist that, and say, well, we just can't go there. But like Peter Dale Scott, I really think you and Oliver Stone are really saying there's a deep politics here, that there's various organizations, military intelligence, the mafia, varying government officials, the CIA, and that not necessarily any single one is dominant, but these things that emerge, the assassination of Kennedy, both Kennedys for that matter, become something that happens inside the deep politics is not transparent. There's decisions that are made that are never brought forward. They're called state crimes against democracy in the public administration literature. Do you have any thoughts on this?
I don't know that these are conspiracies, because these people speak openly about what they do. And they come from the same organizations. Let's look at the George W. Bush administration. Where did all these people come from? What hole do these people crawl out of? You know, what rock were they under? They were all members of the Project for a New American Century. It was founded in 1997, but all of the so-called neocons who had been kind of working on this stuff since the 1970s, at least. You've got Wolfowitz talking about the need to attack Iraq and overthrow that government back in the 1970s. And the people who were around Bush who were pushing for the invasion of Iraq when there was no connection, of course, to 9/11, no other rational reason, were called by the New York Times the Wolfowitz Cabal. And a lot of these people trace back to Scoop Jackson. And they're right-wing Democrats. You know, they don't care about party. So in that sense, you know, party is almost an illusion to entertain the masses. In Halberstam's great book, The Best and the Brightest, he begins with that wonderful passage there about Robert Bruce meeting with Kennedy in the White House. And they're talking about who to have in the Kennedy cabinet. And he's suggesting people. He says, I don't know what their politics are. I don't know what party they're part of. He himself didn't vote for Kennedy. And Kennedy offers him any position he wants in the administration, but they go from Ford Motor Company to the Rockefeller Foundation to the big banks. These people are above party. These people are the ruling class who really runs things. Then you put them together with the ideologues, which is what you had during the Bush administration. So the members of the Project for a New American Century. And they've got a vision of the United States dominating the world. Now, clearly, those people had economic interests. Bush, Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, they were all involved with the oil companies. They have a lot of knowledge about mineral rights in Central Asia. I mean, some of that stuff that started to come out a few years ago, if you trace that back, they were very aware of not only the lithium and everything else that's in Afghanistan and surrounding areas, but they were aware of this for over 100 years. So the economic interests, the military sense of domination, as well as the broad notions of empire, really form part of the same whole. They're parts of the same chestnut. They're part of the same picture. And at certain times, they're going to use diplomacy, which is why we say that Obama is just a more efficient manager of the empire. If you look at his speeches, I was just writing a piece about American exceptionalism. And Obama's words on American exceptionalism, Putin was right to chastise him, but it wasn't only invoking American exceptionalism to justify an attack on Syria. He's been saying this for years. Okay, you can say that he initially questioned American exceptionalism and got pounced upon during the 2008 campaign for doing so. But since that time, he has been as loud a cheerleader for American exceptionalism, the idea that the United States is different. When he greeted the troops on their way back from Iraq at Fort Bragg, he says, that's what makes us great. That's what makes us so different from other countries. We're not there for land. We're not there for power. We're not there for geo-interests. He says what we're there for is to defend American ideals, to defend freedom, to help the people there. In that same line, it was Woodrow Wilson who says after Versailles, now the world will know that the United States is the savior of the world. And that attitude, we saw it in Henry Kissinger. We see it in Hillary Clinton. We saw it over and over again. Madeleine Albright says, if we use force, it's because we're the United States. We're the indispensable nation. We stand tall and we see farther than other countries. That attitude is very dangerous, and Obama imbibes that also.
Well, Peter Kuznick, that's certainly been the official narrative propaganda that we've seen not only over the course of the 20th century into the 21st. We've seen it all the way back to Manifest Destiny and even before that. And just prior in your statements, you were giving us basically a textbook primer on the plutocracy, all of which, you know, again, the JFK assassination, pivotal turning point, again, some historians say in the history and in the history of what blows into more vicious Cold War, and even all the way up to the present with Obama. In closing, we at Project Censored, we write about case studies of unhistory in the making and talk about how we build better futures. So we sort of talk about not just unhistories or untold histories, but we talk about that journalism is the rough draft of history and why it's so important that we have these robust debates and perspectives in the present. And to quote you and Oliver Stone, we began that segment of the book by saying, historical understanding defines people's very sense of what is thinkable and achievable. As a result, many have lost the ability to imagine a world that is substantially different from and better than what exists today. And just for your closing remarks, could you comment a little bit about that and what we hope to achieve here on the 50th anniversary of this tragic event?
Yeah, that was the motivating belief that prompted Oliver and me to do Untold History, to spend 5 years of our lives working on the documentary and the book, and the last year going around everywhere we can to support it. We believe that people's understanding of history is essential, that every person is his or her own historian, that everybody's got a view of history, and that their actions in the present and the future are based upon that view of history, however self-conscious it might be. And so we're fighting over people's understanding of history. We're basing this on the belief that if people have a less corrupt view of history, a more accurate view of history, a more comprehending view of history, can factor in all these other things, rather than just this narrative of the United States being God's gift to humanity, rather than this idea that the United States fights for freedom and democracy around the world, that the United States is different from all other countries because we're altruistic and benevolent. That's such a dangerous view. And so we're trying to fight for a different view because we think that if we can change that understanding of history, we have a chance, we at least have a fighting chance to actually have a more progressive country. And what the United States does in the world, you know, we're, for good or bad, the United States is still the most influential, powerful country. And so Americans' actions are essential to all of humanity. Oliver and I believe that the United States can play a positive, constructive role, not simply the role that is played as the world's policeman, as the world's imperial enforcer, as this force of militarism, unfettered militarism.
We certainly hear what you're saying, and at Project Censored, again, we certainly agree that we need to be uncensoring these narratives. We need to diversify our views and really take a look back and get a more accurate and fact-based type vision of our history so we understand better the present and can more strategically and effectively and more meaningfully have a civic path for a better future.
Well, the Project Censored, you guys are doing a great job on this.
Well, thanks so much, Peter. We really appreciate your time and effort, certainly with Oliver Stone. The 12-chapter documentary series now available on Blu-ray, Untold History of the United States. The book, Untold History of the United States, now available on paper in paperback, Simon & Schuster, Warner Brothers for Untold History. Professor Peter Kuznick, American University, thanks so much for joining us for this special broadcast.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to this special segment on the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. We've been in conversation with award-winning filmmaker Oliver Stone and Professor Peter Kuznick, co-authors of Untold History of the United States. Thanks for joining us.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they owned by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
And that does it for today's Project Censored show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. The Project Censored show now airs on 36 stations around the United States, our most recent in Columbus, Ohio. For more information, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. Special thanks to Anthony Fest, our producer. We'll see you next time. Potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the